My guest tonight is James Corbett of The Corbett Report. He returns to the show tonight. How are you doing, James?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you for having me on again.
Well, thanks for returning. Listen, you've done a number of podcasts and roundtable discussions regarding the Denny Hastert affair with Sybil Evans and a few other guests. Denny Hastert, he was charged last spring with structuring cash withdrawals totaling about $1.7 million. And I guess he was charged that he did it in a manner intended to avoid detection by banking officials. And then giving those funds to a person who's identified as a victim, of sexual abuse, so it didn't have, but that wasn't really the charge. He's charged with structuring, making these illegal withdrawals. He has since pled guilty to those charges and is due to be sentenced, I guess, next year early, and sometime in January. But that's not all that's the case involves. What's going on here?
Well, yes, let's start with what actually he was charged with and how that came about. So for a number of years now, he has been making withdrawals to the purpose of providing $3.5 million in blackmail hush money to someone who was identified by the FBI in their investigation only as Individual A. And that's the name that shows up in the indictment. Individual A has not been named or identified in the media anywhere. So this mysterious individual has been blackmailing Dennis Hastert for a number of years, and so Hastert was withdrawing money from his account for the purpose of paying that off. Initially, he was withdrawing $50,000 at a time until the FBI showed up at his door, because if you do withdraw as much as $10,000 or more at a single time, that does get reported by your bank, and this was seen as unusual activity. So he was actually interviewed about this. And at the time, they asked him something like, what are you using this money for? Are you storing it for financial collapse or something like that? And he said, yes, that's it. I'm worried about financial collapse, so I'm storing money in the house. And they went away. And so he, from that point on, began structuring his withdrawals and keeping them under $10,000 to avoid the reporting rules. And that is really ultimately what these charges are about and what he pled guilty to, which was using these structured withdrawals to try to avoid the detection of the $10,000 limit. So that's ultimately what this is about. And it was only in the media reporting of the case that the allegations that this had to do with sexual abuse was brought out and talked about. And this goes back to his time teaching at a high school in Yorkville, Illinois, back in the late 1960s, where he was teaching history and coaching wrestling at a high school. And there are allegations that he was a serial sexual abuser of minors at that high school. And only one victim has come out by name. And in fact, it wasn't the victim themselves that came out. It was the victim's sister. And the name of this person off the top of my head, I do not remember the name, but the person was someone that he had coached in high school by the name of Burge. Burge was the family name. And in 1979, this young man told his sister about the sexual abuse that he had suffered at the hands of Dennis Hastert in around 1969, 1970, 1971, that time frame. Interestingly enough, that man ultimately went on to die of AIDS in 1995, and Hastert actually came to show up at the viewing, which obviously angered his sister, and she claims that she actually confronted him about this at the time. She said, "I was just there trying to bite my tongue, thinking that blood was coming out, because I was just..." So after he had gone through the line, I followed him into the parking lot of the funeral home. I said, "I want to know why you did that, what you did to my brother." And he just stood there and stared at me. He didn't say, "What are you talking about?" You know, or "What? I don't know what you're talking about." He just stood there and stared at me. Then I continued to say, "I want you to know your secret didn't die in there with my brother. And I want you to remember that I'm out here and that I know." And again, he just stood there and did not say a word. So this was the on-the-record testimony of Burge, who attempted to break this scandal a decade ago, but there was no real media coverage of this at the time, and that was when Hastert was actually the sitting Speaker of the House. So that is about as far as the mainstream narrative of the Hastert scandal goes. So just so everyone's on the same page, Hastert, of course, was the Speaker of the House from, I believe, 1998 until 2006, 2007, that time frame. sorry, 1999 to 2007. And in that time frame, he, of course, was one of the highest ranking officials in the U.S. government, just a couple of heartbeats away from the presidency, as it were. And oversaw and presided over many important bills and the passage of much important legislation. Now, his career is somewhat interesting if you take a look at some of the highlights of it. After leaving high school as the wrestling coach, he was standing for election at the state house primary in Illinois and came in third place, but ultimately ended up winning because the winner died. And the Republicans chose him, the third place contestant, to replace the winner. And he ended up winning the general election. So he got into the state legislature. And then eventually he was he made his way into the ranks of the Congress by another interesting death. In 1986, he was nominated to replace a Republican congressman who was battling cancer, and he won the close election that resulted. So he got his way, his foot in the door a couple of times, and then rocketed to the very top position. And how did he rocket to the very top position? Well, that plays into the whole scandal and what's really behind this. And this information goes to a series of startling podcasts that Sybil Edmonds has been releasing over the past several months at her website, boilingfrogspost.com. I'm going to assume that your listeners know about Sybil Edmonds, but if not, she was an FBI translator working in the Washington field office in the wake of 9/11 for several months from 2001 to 2002, and she was working on active investigations that stretched back from 1996 all the way up to 2002 that involved agents in different offices in counterterrorism in various offices around the country. Now, one of the things that she revealed in these podcasts is that the mid-1990s was a politically interesting time for a number of reasons. Of course, people can cast their mind back and remember that Bill Clinton was, of course, in the mid-1990s facing a series of sex scandals. And in between the Paula Jones scandal and the Monica Lewinsky scandal, which was just coming out in the mid-1990s, the Clinton White House issued a directive to the Department of Justice that directed the DOJ to start a new program using FISA laws, the FISA abilities of the FBI, to start wiretapping members of Congress in various ways, or getting the goods on them through surveillance of one sort or another. Now, this program was the actual name of the program, or what the directive actually said about this, is not known. But the agents who were working on this called it COINTELPRO 2, according to Edmonds. So they had this sort of secret program that was going on in the mid-1990s, late 1990s, to try to dig up dirt on, ostensibly on Republican congressmen for the purposes of blackmailing them to stop them from trying to impeach President Clinton. As a result of the Lewinsky scandal. And part of this deal was that they were going to release any of the dirt on any of the congressmen who dared to step forward and try to bring up the information on Clinton. Now, this was actually extremely effective because in that time period, people might remember in the run-up to the impeachment, there were a series of pretty startling announcements of basically people announcing infidelities, stepping down from their positions. You had people like Henry Hyde, Helen Chenoweth, and Dan Burton all admitting to adulterous affairs in the months leading up to that impeachment, with Dan Burton actually admitting to fathering a child out of wedlock. Pretty startling revelation there. Perhaps the biggest name to fall in that was the Speaker of the House at the time, Bob Livingston, who actually resigned on the day that they began deliberations for the impeachment because of an explosive expose that had come out via Larry Flynt that he had also engaged in adulterous relationships. And Larry Flynt was claiming at the time that he had an audio tape of Bob Livingston engaged in raunchy phone sex that he could reveal to the world. So Livingston stepped down, resigned that day, and Hastert was the one who ultimately ended up replacing him. Now, obviously, the tactic here was not successful ultimately in stopping Congress from impeaching President Clinton, who, of course, was impeached. But it was a rather lame impeachment. In fact, if anything, it really only served to bolster Clinton's popularity in the general public after he survived that, and his reputation really only grew from that point. So it was a pretty politically ineffective thing. But the point is that a lot of dirt was collected and released on a lot of congressmen, and according to Edmonds, the raunchy phone sex tape that was collected on Speaker Livingston was from this COINTELPRO2 program that the FBI was running as part of this DOJ mandate from the White House. Now, fast forward a few years, and you start to have the problem of this ongoing investigation of various Congress members that's collecting all of this information. But of course, when you're collecting on for compromising information on certain congressmen and women, you're going to start collecting information, even if only by proxy, on a number of other criminal individuals involved in government, including some on the Democrats' quote-unquote own team. So you started to get a large amount of information being collected on a large amount of people, including some very serious information that pointed to some extremely serious crimes of drug running, money laundering, bribery, and unfortunately, child rape as well. And this information was being collected by agents in the FBI who were increasingly incensed, specifically in the counterintelligence unit where this directive was being run through. They were getting increasingly incensed that this information, all of this evidence that they were collecting of actual wiretaps and surveillance that they were conducting on these people, was not being used for prosecution as they were told it was going to be used. Yeah, and really nothing was happening about this.
So,
And
sorry, you have FBI agents that are forced to listen to and observe children being raped.
unfortunately so. And
Okay.
this took place not only in the United States, but also outside of the United
Okay.
States. And that information, of course, collected by the Central Intelligence Agency,
Yeah, because
which,
people often
is
forget the human aspect of this.
unfortunately so,
Yeah,
yes.
basically,
So
with
there
the.
are. Of course, the implication here is not that the FBI is some monolithic organization that's helping to cover up child abuse as a totality. There are agents on the ground who genuinely do care about these things and genuinely are incensed by the information they're collecting. But they were told for years that we're collecting this information for part of a prosecution. But in 2001, 2002, the entire program was shut down on the basis of the fact that this information, this surveillance information, was being collected in defiance of FISA laws and regulations, and thus it could not be prosecuted. The idea here is the principle of the fruit of the poison tree. If the evidence itself is collected in illegal ways, then it can't be used for prosecution. So basically, all of this information that the agents had been collecting over these years was just swept under the rug. This caused one FBI agent, at least that we know of, through an unred or a the unredacted section of a complaint that he filed, specifically Gilbert Graham, who was a special agent in the Washington field office, complained about this and was talking about violations of FISA that were in conducting electronic surveillance as a subterfuge to acquire evidence of criminal activity. This is in the unclassified version of his complaint, which is available online and which I linked in my own video on this subject so people can go and read it. But yes, so you started to have FBI agents coming out and questioning this and saying what's going on and threatening to retire or quit over the shutdown of this investigation. Now, according to Russell Tice, who of course was an NSA whistleblower who has made some pretty startling accusations in the last couple of years that have gone almost completely unnoticed by the mainstream media. Basically, the NSA took up where the FBI left off. And Russ Tice talked about on my program, as well as on Boiling Frogs Post podcast, he talked about how he actually handled the wiretap orders for a number of high-ranking congressmen, military personnel, lawyers, judges, basically a lot of important people in Washington, including, actually, interestingly, a little-known state senator by the name of Barack Obama, who was at the time in 2004 not exactly a nationally known figure, but anyway, he was part of the people that the NSA was specifically wiretapping through their through their satellite surveillance capabilities. So yeah. Basically, after 9/11, the entire program shifted from the FBI and their counter COINTELPRO 2 program into the NSA, which, of course, was becoming the behemoth that we now know that it is. So this is the sort of background and context under which Dennis Hastert rose to power as the Speaker of the House. Again, someone who had serially been placed into not just the State House in the Illinois, but in Congress as well, because of the suspiciously timely deaths of some of his political opponents. And now this man who has this, this shady past that we now know of with regards at least to his high school sexual activities, is rocketing up to pretty much the top of the political ladder. So we have to understand that there was information being collected on a number of people, including, again, according to the FBI sources, including Hastert. Now, Hastert has been identified before in a couple of different cases over the years with regards to this. Not only, as I talked about before, the accusations by Burge that her brother had been abused by Hastert, but also in 2006, of course, there was the Mark Foley scandal with the pages in Congress who were being abused. And Hastert was accused of covering up that case at the time, that he had been informed of those activities, but had basically allowed them to go on. So that accusation was floating around at the time. And again, it was Larry Flynt was sponsoring a number of investigations into this activity. And one of those included Wayne Madsen, who people might know from the Wayne Madsen Report, who did his own investigation, traveling to a number of countries, and through his own sources managed to piece together a child prostitution ring, really, that was being run through the, not the State Department as an organization, but through various embassies in countries in Southeast Asia, including in Thailand and Vietnam, as well as in the Northern Marianas, which was a U.S. district that became infamous during the Foley scandal as a place where child prostitution was rife, and that was overseen by Mark Foley, who at the time was chairing the, I can't remember which particular committee, but I think it was
Missing and Exploited Children.
Yes, Missing and Exploited Children, exactly. So that came under the purview of Mark Foley, who, of course, we now know was also exploiting children, to say the very least. So again, this entire web leads back to Hastert, who was one of the individuals that was implicated specifically, for example, in that Wayne Madsen report from 2006. And we also have this from other angles. In 2005, Vanity Fair did an in-depth report on the accusations that Sybil Edmonds was making at that time, that Hastert was being bribed by various foreign agents. And they did a really thorough report that talked to various FBI sources, as well as sources in the State Department, court documents, all sorts of different records that they marshaled to at least raise the issue of Hastert and his what kind of practices he was involved in as Speaker of the House, including the accusation that got a little bit of traction and was at least featured on Democracy Now! At the time, that he had accepted bribes in order to scuttle the congressional resolution against Turkey and the Armenian genocide. At the time, the only response that was forthcoming was from a Hastert speaker representative who said, "Well, that's ridiculous. Of course, Mr. Hastert has no connection whatsoever to Turkey." Which is interesting, because immediately upon resigning his position or stepping down as Speaker and leaving the House, he ended up registering as a foreign lobby for what country? Yes, Turkey. So, again, immediately shown to be a lie. So these are the types of accusations that are going around, that basically Hastert was involved in a criminal operation that included child sex trafficking and child rape, but also money laundering, drug running, bribery, these types of activities that the FBI and the NSA presumably did have actual evidence on, but was being used for political blackmail purposes rather than prosecution, which is why this particular case about Individual A and the structured withdrawals is interesting, insofar as it seems that someone at some lower level of the ladder actually started to stumble onto a much bigger story And the damage control teams went into overdrive to make sure that none of the real accusations came to light. And this was even noted in the media at the time, that noted that the indictment itself was unusually circumspect with regards to what it would say or would not say about this case. Usually an indictment will sort of make more of the investigation and what it actually knows known as, you know, the indictment to start the court proceedings. But this one seemed like there had already been wrangling going on behind the scenes even before the indictment was released. So so that, for example, we know that individual A is apparently or was apparently blackmailing Dennis Hastert to the tune of millions of dollars. But not only do we not see any sort of, I mean, prosecution of this individual who, I mean, blackmail is actually a crime, so one would assume the FBI would be going after this person. But not only that, but I mean, the person isn't even identified, and none of the details of this blackmail or what it was about it has been released. So that's on its face, that itself is extremely unusual. But then, of course, you get ultimately the judge in the case who has multiple connections to Hastert, not only having donated to his political campaigns, but having a son that having worked in an office that his son had worked in, and other connections like that, which of course made it a conflict of interest, such a glowing and glaring one that the judge himself asked the prosecutors and the defendants, should I recuse myself from this case? And both the prosecutors and defendants decided, no, you seem perfectly the great best judge for this. So the case proceeded. And of course, Hastert it engaged in a plea deal, which means that none of the details of this case will ever be revealed. He is due to be sentenced in February. The prosecutors have recommended 0 to 6 months as his potential prison time. So it's perfectly plausible and, in fact, quite likely that Hastert will see exactly zero time behind bars, even for this little bit of the puzzle that seems to have come out recently. And it looks like all of this brouhaha is just going to be swept under the rug.
Yeah, and he'll still have his millions that he's pocketed.
Exactly right. And yeah, exactly. He has certainly pocketed millions over the last several years as a registered foreign lobbyist for the Turkish government in Washington.
And his freaking flyer miles.
Unfortunately so, yeah.
But the structuring, until fairly recently, structuring was a crime only if it was related to a predicate crime. Meaning that if
right.
you were, yeah. Now, I think it was ironically, Hastert shepherded the law through, was some sort of Department of Homeland Security or post 9/11 legislation that created the very legislation that ensnared him.
The other part of that is that he also lied to federal agents when they came after his initial withdrawals.
Now,
and
Is he being tried? I mean, is he being penalized for that as well?
I know that was the indictment was twofold. One was the structured withdrawals and the other was lying to federal agents. I don't know if that lying to federal agents charge is part of the plea deal. I assume that it is.
Yeah. Again, usually when you're looking at structuring, the first thing a prosecutor does, and I think you alluded to it, is look for another crime, because there's a reason why the money's being paid out, whether it's blackmail or given that the Speaker of the House was obviously being blackmailed, you might be interested in what's he being blackmailed for. You know, so but they do know why he was blackmailed. They just don't want to look because it opens up a huge can of worms.
But the question, of course, is who knows? And I think at the lower levels that brought these charges in the first place and was investigating it, I'm sure they were not aware of this information. Mm-hmm. But at the higher levels, obviously, this information exists, and that's why it was so quickly swept under the carpet.
Yeah, and much of the story Sybil Evans became privy to as her position as a translator for the FBI in the early 2000s.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, of course, she ultimately ended up attempting to blow the whistle. She went through the proper channels, ultimately ended up getting fired. Her case was taken up by various Congress members who said that they were going to help with regards to her case. The Bush White House ultimately ended up invoking the the name of the state secrets privilege. Yeah. Yes, the state secrets privilege in her case, not once, I believe twice, which ultimately led to the absurd position of basically everything of relevance to her entire life becoming officially classified material, to the point where she couldn't legally say where she was born or what languages she spoke or anything else that pertained whatsoever to her work with the FBI. Again, an absurd state of affairs that at one point I remember her saying that she didn't know if she was pulled over by a police officer who wanted to see her license, if that would actually be a violation of the state secrets privilege. I mean, just an absurd state of affairs that led to her being dubbed by the ACLU, I believe, back in 2004, the most gagged woman or the most gagged person in the history of the United States. Mm-hmm. And this, I mean, so the fight ultimately went to the Supreme Court. There was the court battle going on. And, of course, the long story short, nothing ultimately came of this. She ultimately got her case squashed and had to ultimately resort to starting her own website and self-publishing her own book, because, of course, the FBI wouldn't grant her clearance. And they're obligated, actually, to deny clearance on anything that an FBI agent writes within, I can't remember what the time frame is, I believe it's 1 month or something of it being submitted to the FBI for clearance. The FBI wouldn't even acknowledge that she had sent them anything. And after, I think, a year or two, and after all of these publishers would turn her down because, well, it hasn't been cleared by the FBI, she ultimately self-published her own account, which is called Classified Woman. And people can find that book at classifiedwoman.com talking about her case. But the real part of the case that I think is relevant is that when she started to indicate that this, you know, this isn't just information about those dirty Republicans, this also includes a lot of Democrats. I mean, it's both sides of the aisle. Suddenly, all of the Democrat congressmen that had been, you know, standing up and interested in the case suddenly dropped it. Mm-hmm. Like a hot potato. And Sybil ultimately went from something of a star in the sort of left-wing version of the pseudo-alternative media, the Democracy Nows and what have you, to being persona non grata, who will not be featured on any of those outlets anymore, because she doesn't just talk about one side of the aisle being sleazebags. It's definitely both sides. And that's ultimately the same problem, I guess, that the FBI encountered when they started digging up information on both sides of the aisle with regards to the COINTELPRO 2 operation. Mm-hmm.
State secrets, that's an interesting history here in the United States, because contrary or to what exists like in England, where they have the Official Secrets Act, I think it's called. In the United States, it's not law. It's a judicial precedent or decision that was made on a court case. A family was suing, I think, the United States Air Force regarding the crash of one of its planes. And what happened was the family was claiming negligence, and the Air Force, the Department of Defense, claimed it was state secrets. They couldn't reveal information pertinent because it would reveal national security information regarding the plane itself, how it was put together, its construction, or something like that. So the court developed the state secrets doctrine. There's no law in the books. And so it's very vague, and so they just invoke national security and cover something up. Well, it came out 10, 15 years ago that in that particular case, the government was lying. They were covering up negligence. And so the very doctrine of state secrets privilege is based on lies.
Yes, and people who are interested in that can see, I think it's United States v. Reynolds.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm glad you remember that. Yeah, U.S. versus Reynolds. The government did lie, and they continued. But basically, they just invoked national security to cover up negligence or incompetence or criminal behavior, you know, for the most part. So that's something that should be remembered when you're talking about the state secrets privilege that they constantly invoke to cover things up or purportedly to protect national security, whatever.
Exactly. But it's been used, well, it was used very, very rarely up until the time of the Bush administration. And with the Sybil Edmonds case, the floodgates were opened and it was invoked quite a lot more regularly. But interestingly, one of the people that it applied to before Edmonds was the whistleblower whose name is going to escape my memory at the moment, but I did talk about him in a report I filed a few years ago, who was blowing the whistle about how the United States was basically aiding Pakistan in the creation of their nuclear weapons program, basically allowing it to go forward. And he had the state secrets privilege invoked in his case. So it is a pretty good sign when that state secrets privilege is invoked that the person that it is being invoked on is trying to tell the public about something very, very important.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So what the Hastert case exposes, and yet another case where it exposes this something, a system that lurks just beneath the surface here, of a sort of an organized pedophilia ring that is involved in not only satisfying the perverted desires of certain elite political elites or officials, but in blackmail. And we've had a number of cases that have exposed this throughout the years. Oh, a similar one was the case of the so-called DC madam, Deborah Jean Palfrey, who supposedly committed suicide after she was, I guess, convicted for racketeering.
And after specifically stating in public that she would not commit suicide.
Yeah, hanging herself, yeah. Well, she ran a place, I guess, the operation called Pamela Martin Associates. What's interesting about that case is that she didn't get the attention of the FBI until she shut down that operation. Because the FBI was using it for blackmail, you know, or reportedly.
Of course. Know. Well, yes. But quite obviously, when she shut down, then everyone gets very interested in the case. And then when she says, well, I have the client list and I could reveal it, she ends up committing, quote unquote, suicide. Okay. So.
Now, this wasn't pedophilia. This was the escort servicing adults. But she had a client list, supposedly of 15,000 names. ABC News says they looked at it and found no one of interest in it. I find that hard to believe. But Wayne Mattson, which you mentioned, had an interesting story regarding her case, is that in the course of her court battles, her lawyers tried to invoke the Classified Information Procedures Act, which is only used for matters of national security. And there's some evidence to say that some of her employees – were privy to information regarding 9/11 and foreknowledge. It's hard to confirm that, but her suicide, is certainly curious. That attempt to invoke that law, is very interesting because it really had no place in that case if it was just an escort service. So something was cooking in that story that hasn't been reported on. When Mastin reported on that, you're familiar with Henry Vincent, and he wrote a book with Nick Bryant, "Confessions of a DC Madam."
I know Nick Bryant. I'm not sure I know Henry Vincent.
Henry Vincent, he was a mortician, whose mortician services were being utilized as a call boy ring. And what happened was, a gay escort service. And this ensnared people like Donald Gregg, who was the national security advisor for George Bush and eventually ambassador to South Korea. He was also a CIA operative, CIA agent. And he got caught because Donald Gregg was using his credit card, government credit card, to bill for the services. And GSA called Henry Vincent up saying, hey, why why are these tens of thousands of dollars charged for mortician services? And he referred him to Donald Gregg. And he got a visit from a couple of thugs there, I think, were actually Secret Service agents, and they were he was threatened with imprisonment if he didn't call off, help call off the hounds on Donald Gregg, and he ended up going to prison for a couple of years. But what's interesting that he was linked up with Craig Spence, who has connections to the Franklin scandal.
Right.
He ran that house on Capitol Hill that was wired for audiovisual.
Right, right.
More blackmail. And I think Craig Spence videotaped him admitting him running a call, an escort service, a gay escort service, and he used that to blackmail him to try to get him to traffic with boys. And Henry Vincent said he wouldn't do that. I'm not going to do that. And that's when he got in trouble. So that there's a connection there. That's one of these things where, these things kind of link together,
Yeah.
And of course, the Franken scandal, with Lawrence King and the Franken scandal with Boys Town, Lawrence King was supplying children to Craig Spence, who was then utilizing these children to service politicians and officials in Washington D.C., then videotaping them and blackmailing them. So it's a whole system here.
Yes, and unfortunately, this is not just an American phenomenon. It really is worldwide, as we're discovering more and more, not only with, of course, the still ongoing revelations related to the Jimmy Savile affair in Britain and all of the surrounding information that's coming out about various high-ranking British politicians, but we've seen this before. We saw it in the Netherlands with the Demink case. We saw it in Belgium with the De Tru affair. It seems in a number of different political systems, it seems that child abusers continue to rise to the highest ranks of power and then cover up these types of stories. And I think there must be an underlying connection there that, in terms of the principle behind what's going on.
Do you remember the late Ted Gunderson?
I certainly do.
And I remember when I first saw his videos, I was like, this guy's insane. You know, I was like, where is he getting this? CIA, Satanism, pedophilia, what? But the more you look into it, you start to connect dots and see kind of see the how the system works, you know. But he when he did a report on the Finders cult, they were a group that were caught in Tallahassee with a bunch of boys, a bunch of kids in a van. They were all dirty and neglected, and the investigation went all the way up to D.C. because they had an office in D.C. And that investigation was shut down by the CIA for reasons of national security. And they were caught with like a with fax machine at the time, state-of-the-art technology, fax machines, stuff like that. And they had catalogs of kids, weird, all types of satanic, weird stuff they found in the office. But they had, basically, this appears to be a service that was supplying foreign, dignitaries, officials with young children to exploit. And from that, I think we can infer from that is whether it's some sort of bribery slash blackmail system that's operating with the connivance of the intelligence agencies.
Yes. And I think this is ultimately what, for example, what Sibel was gesturing at with regards to what she's talked about in the Hastert case, which was interestingly fictionalized a couple of years ago in a book she wrote called The Lone Gladio that I hope your listeners will be familiar with. But basically, that's a quote unquote book work of fiction in which I believe it was the chief whip of the house in the book travels to Vietnam for one of these types of offerings. So that he's offered a child sex with a couple of young girls that is, of course, being videotaped not only by a foreign blackmail ring, but also by the CIA. That basically the CIA discovers there's another level of surveillance going on. So it's kind of, I don't know, I don't want to say humorous, but
No, I know,
that type of situation at which one could very much imagine goes on in these types of circles. Because again, having that type of information on politicians is absolutely 100%. This is the best form of blackmail that you could hope to achieve if you were trying to put a congressman or woman or Congress card or various sorts in your back pocket. And this is very much in line with what we saw, for example, with the De Tru affair. About the child serial killer, ultimately the investigation surrounding that, which wasn't so much about De Tru himself, but was about all of the information that came out about the Belgian law enforcement authorities and how they had a dossier of information about various high-ranking Belgian politicians and officials who were engaged in child rape, and how that information was initially, it was denied. We don't have that type of dossier. And then it was like, oh, yes, we have it, but it's not really important. And that scandal, which really shook the core of the Belgian society, which I think, again, provides an insight into this, that ultimately, of course, these dossiers exist because they are extremely useful to people who want to control the people who are in those positions of power.
And then just recently we've had the Jeffrey Epstein case.
Yes, and
Another
the
plea
flights
deal.
with Bill Clinton and others, of
Yeah,
course.
and of course, the police down there also report that his house was wired for sound, audiovisual. That's not official, but that leaks out of the police department down there claim. And when they went into the house there, there was all types of audiovisual set up, and his connections possibly to Robert Maxwell's daughter.
I don't know about that.
Yeah, is Robert Maxwell's daughter is his like aide-de-camp or assistant who would
Ah,
procure young
yes,
girls
right.
for him. And of course, Robert Maxwell, whenever you have Jeffrey Epstein, who's this billionaire, and Robert Maxwell, who is alleged to be a Mossad agent. So when you talk about intelligence agencies, I could very, you see the name Jeffrey Epstein, billionaire, supplying dignitaries, people like Larry Summers, Bill Clinton, Alan Dershowitz, Ehud Barak apparently was on the list on his plane there, I think. You think, oh, Mossad. they're in on it too, right?
Like, right. To be fair, not all of those names, I believe, were confirmed to be on the plane, but they were all in his personal contact book.
Yeah, and of course, Donald Trump has said he was a good friend of Jeffrey Epstein. There's a recording of him talking about Jeffrey Epstein saying that he's a lot of fun to be around with, and he likes the women. A little young, but that's okay. I mean, geez. Yeah. I mean, but no one's talking about that now.
Yeah, of course. You know? Right.
I think you had a roundtable a couple of weeks ago with Wayne Mattson, Sybil Evans, and
Peter B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, yeah, Peter B. Collins. And Wayne Mattson told you about the story of John Mark Carr, the teacher who was charged with sex abuse in California, and he skipped bail went to Asia, became a language teacher in Thailand.
Thailand, right.
Okay. Then he confesses to killing JonBenet Ramsey after he's charged in Thailand with pedophilia. Okay. The CIA gets involved, gets him flown back to the United States, and then the charges are dropped because he's obviously not guilty of the JonBenet Ramsey affair. And the evidence for him that was in California went missing, the computer file. It was in lockup in the police, and the evidence for him went missing, and he's in the clear.
Right.
You know, that type of official help.
Yeah, exactly. The evidence somehow walked out of the evidence room, never seen again.
Yeah. You know, it's something else. I mean, you know, and then there's also the Presidio case, you know, recently with, of course, that involved Michael Aquino, and he's involved with the Phoenix program and psychological warfare with the Pentagon. Yes. He's also the head chaplain who wrote the manual for chaplains for the Pentagon.
Right. Yes. No, I was listening to an interview you did that on, I can't remember with whom, but you were talking about that recently. I found that quite fascinating.
Brandon Turberville, yeah.
Yes, that's it. Mm-hmm.
And guess who was over, according to John Potash, Courtney Love was one of the children at the Presidio Child Daycare Center in the 70s.
Yes.
And guess it's been reported that she herself was a drug mule, a prostitute for the CIA. You know,
unfortunately, that doesn't actually surprise me.
I mean, if you told me this 10 years ago, I would have said, oh, come on.
Yeah.
But when you look into it, you realize, oh, okay, it all adds up. And to the average person, this stuff sounds too far-fetched and crazy.
Exactly. And the worst part of it is that this is so widespread and so common a phenomenon. I mean, we've just listed at least half a dozen cases that themselves were incredibly large investigations with all sorts of different characters. I mean, you need a map to find your way through these cases and who's who and no, not that Larry King and things like that, it becomes so overwhelming to even dip your toe into this. I did an episode of my podcast on political pedophilia where, again, all I could do was gesture to some of the many, many cases that have come out with regards to this. And I think the real question is, ultimately, why does this continue to happen? Why is this happening not just as some isolated affair? One can imagine that at some point in time, a group of child abusers get into power and protect each other. But why does this happen over and over and over and over in generation after generation, in country after country? It seems like there's something more of an underlying phenomenon going on here than simply a single group of child abusers.
Which brings me to the topic. You had a interview, very interesting interview, last spring with Tirjid Andringa.
Tirjid Andringa, yes.
Andringa. He's a professor in the Netherlands.
That's right, at the University of Groningen.
And he had a theory called kakistocracy. In the time we have remaining, which is about 16, maybe 15, 12, 13 minutes, do you want to explain that and what's the import of that theory, the explanatory power of that theory?
Yes. Well, a kakistocracy is a word that means government by the least qualified or the most unprincipled people, the worst people, as it were. And that could be, I mean, there's different ways to interpret that. But I think the way that Cheard and I were talking about that was in the sense of evil, the rule by evil people. And the word itself dates back, at least the first known instance of its usage was 1829. The English writer Thomas Love Peacock used it in The Misfortunes of Elphin. The American poet James Russell Lowell actually used it in 1876. He wrote a letter in which he said, "Is ours a government of the people, by the people, for the people, or a cacistocracy, rather, for the benefit of knaves at the cost of fools?" And I would perhaps amend that to say for the benefit of the elite psychopaths at the cost of everybody else. I don't know, something of that sort. But I think that this is perhaps similar to those who talk about the pathocracy, basically ruled by a bunch of psychopaths who have gotten into power. I think ultimately it comes to the same thing, which is that when you have a clique of evil people, I mean, let's use the adjective. I don't think anyone would hesitate to use that when we talk about these child rapists and others. When you have that clique that gets into positions of power, then they can foster a system that institutionalizes those kinds of abuses. And that's done, of course, through cover-up and through nudges and winks and through investigations that don't start in the first place or get squashed quite quickly, as we saw with Hastert. And that it's a self-perpetuating system. Now, the interesting part of this, I think everyone can understand that who gets into these types of, you know, alternative explanations can understand that. But I think the interesting part that Cheard and I were exploring in that interview is the idea that ultimately the cacistocracy serves to start to mold society in its own image. And one of the interesting effects that's been talked about and explored in the alt media, I think certainly in recent years, is the idea that child sexual abuse can be used as a form of conditioning towards the purpose of mind control, that it tends to create split personalities in people, and that the trauma from these events can be used as a way to implant suggestions in those people that make them more pliable to authority figures. And so the sickest part of this is that the victims of this cacistocracy, this evil elite ruling clique, themselves get transformed into a moldable, pliable sort of class that can be used towards the purposes of that very same cacistocracy, which is something of a tangential point in one way, but I think it goes to the how the system itself really perpetuates itself and why it lasts not only for a specific time and place, but why it continues to endure for generations.
The idea here is you can well, one thing is that method was part of MKUltra, if witnesses and the evidence is to be believed. The idea of using trauma-based mind control and children being particularly good targets for that. Yes. Because they can't contextualize what's being done to them. And the shattering effect of a child when adults do this to them, because they're expecting to be nurtured and cared for by these adults. So you can, in essence, you can maybe create out of a percentage of your victims, you can spawn psychopaths.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And so, well, if not psychopaths and sociopaths, people make the distinction. Psychopath is the genetic inborn trait that a small percentage, maybe 2-3% of the population, has to simply not be able to experience human emotions in the way that you and I do. Mm-hmm. But sociopaths are more people created in the image of psychopaths who tend to lose their whatever moral compass they may have had in the pursuit of power or other types of incentives. And that's the phenomenon explored by people like Philip Zimbardo in his Stanford Prison Experiment. And he had some really interesting talks about the what happened at Abu Ghraib and the way that these seemingly normal U.S. Servicemen from various parts of the country, the Midwest, sort of salt of the earth people, ultimately ended up becoming these horrific torturers and abusers. And he talked about the way that that can happen in the context of an environment that allows that to be perpetuated, in the same way that cacistocracy really tries to take that Abu Ghraib phenomenon and write it at large in our society to really create a society that starts to lose its moral compass. This phenomenon has been talked about before in various ways. And I think one way to visualize it is in the context, for example, of a corporation, which has been has been examined for its pathocracy in various by various people over the years and in various documentaries. And I can't remember the name of a documentary, but one that I have referenced on my report before talked about the idea that in a corporate system where the leadership is part of the sort of psychopathic, very, very few percent of the population, that the people coming up in that system necessarily have to become sociopathic, have to act in the image of the psychopath in order to get ahead in that organization. And if our very governments are structured around these types of kakistocracy systems, then ultimately, what does that mean about the people who rise in systems like that? And I think that's the context in which we can understand the rise of someone like Hastert, someone who comes in third in a primary for the House elections and ultimately ends up getting in, and then ultimately ends up getting into congressman because a Republican dies and he gets thrown into that position, and then Livingston gets taken down and so Hastert gets thrown in. One has to ask, how does someone have a charmed career like that? And I think one obvious glaring answer would be because he is so easily controlled because of the amount of dirt that exists on him.
Mm-hmm. And that would explain his meteoric rise. I mean, this guy's why they'd want someone so compromised to get into power. Well, you want someone compromised. Otherwise, that's how you keep them on a short leash. I think it might have been The Godfather in the book, not the movie. But there's a discussion with Michael Corleone, and there's an official who's giving them trouble. And they go, well, he's honest. And he's an honest man. How do you work with a guy like that? Again, if you get into some of this weird, the satanic cult angle, there's a functional quality to there because, well, one the satanic angle, if you get into some of the esoteric meaning behind all this, the spiritual quality to it, is that the intelligence agencies themselves have always had sort of an occulted or secret, obviously they're secret, and so that's occulted knowledge. And that goes way back to their foundations, really, because if you think about, who was it, Aleister Crowley, who was the founder of the OTO, and his doctrine was do what thou wilt, and he was reportedly an MI6 agent.
Again, unfortunately, not surprising.
Yeah, not surprising. So this sort of ethic, if you want to call it that, or lack thereof, or philosophy, pervades these institutions to their very founding. It's sort of an extreme Machiavellian approach to getting what you want, meeting your achieving your ends.
Yes.
Exactly. But again, with a lot of these cases, if you look at a lot of these weird satanic cults, that also are assets for the intelligence agencies because they'll do the drug running, the human trafficking.
Right. Yeah. Yes. And I think you're gesturing towards something very important, which is that the intelligence agencies really are just occult orders that have, developed into what they are today, into the sort of bureaucratic institutional entities that were instituted in the United States through the National Security Act. I think that's when we started to see the formation, the formalization of the deep state, which up to that point had still functioned largely through the same people and through the same types of structures, but they were just occult structures on their face. For example, of course, Skull and Bones being famously the recruiting grounds of the CIA, and where the CIA really ultimately finds most of its membership from, certainly in its early years, demonstrably so, and continuing through people like the Bush family. I think it's in that context that we see where this idea arises, because, for example, with Skull and Bones, of course, people have talked about the initiation rituals and lying in a coffin, either engaging in masturbatory practices or revealing one's secrets to one's quote-unquote brothers under the skin, and kissing skulls and all of these types of, just bizarre things that go on. And to think that, George H.W. Bush, George W. Bush, John Kerry, all of these upstanding, highest ranks of the political sphere, people engaged in these types of bizarre ceremonies. I mean, at first glance, people might just look at it and almost see it as something just absurd or something weird, something they couldn't compute. But I think there is a deeper significance to that, of course, this is the indoctrination into that very type of system where the more you reveal and the more that you are sort of exposing yourself, then the the higher up you're going to get. And I think that started from these types of secret occult orders and things of that nature, and where it was institutionalized in things like the CIA, which, of course, again, as an institutional bureaucratic entity as a whole, is not, I think, directly comparable to that. But of course, it's the idea of compartmentalization. And if you know the right people in the right places in the right departments, then you can join the right clique and get into the right programs, which may or may not be known to anyone else that you're working with. And this is ultimately the structure that the secret agencies / secret societies work on. And I think that perpetuates, invades, and has ultimately completely subsumed the ostensibly open government, the real government, the front government, whatever you want to call it, which is, of course, just a puppet government for the shadow government.
Mm-hmm. Secret agencies spawn from secret societies. So you wouldn't be surprised by these things. Well, James, listen, I want to thank you for coming on tonight. It was a great talk. We could, again, talk for a long time about these things, but all I can say is just read the books, read The Franklin Cover-Up, The Franklin Scandal. Go to your website, James Corbett, thecorbettreport.com, and you have the open source investigation of political pedophilia. And so if people read the material there, listen to the podcast, some of this will make more sense to them.
Yes, and let me just say that I would like to, I hope, I would assume that I don't have to say this for your listeners, for the benefit of your listeners, but if there is anyone who's listening to you for the first time, I would wholeheartedly encourage them to listen to and subscribe to this podcast, because although I don't always agree with find interesting things in your guests, I do always find interesting things in your comments, and you're clearly a very well-researched person. So.
Well, thank you.
I do appreciate the interviews that you do, and I hope people will listen to your podcast at greater length.
Well, listen, James, good night. I'll let you get the rest of your evening. Enjoy the rest of your evening, and maybe we'll talk again soon.
Looking forward to it. Anytime. Thank you.
Take care.